Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president of ReviewLess and friend of Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it or put it on your iPod, iPad, and decide to hit play. Today we revisit the topic of international law and e-discovery show, which truly is even more accurate than most listeners would know. George Rudoy, who's on the show with me, and I did a show about a month and a half ago, and just to show that e-discovery is not the only space where things can go wrong, the show got over re-recorded over at the end, basically. It was a processing job gone awry, and so we decided to do it again. And so we are revisiting the topic of international law and e-discovery today. But even before that, I did a show early on with Jim Daly, and I've had some panelists from the UK talk about primarily European e-discovery. And today we're going to talk to two panelists who've had a deep exposure to the topic. One worked in many projects around the country while at one of the country's largest law firms. The other has been involved in the field based on his substantial training and experience as a judge. Today they offer some unique perspectives to this space, which often adds a degree of complexity to electronic discovery. And our first panelist, as I mentioned, is George Rudoy, who's a veteran of legal technology and the services industry. He's the founder and CEO at Integrated Legal Technology, LLC, which is a consultancy that provides a broad spectrum of advice on a variety of legal technology and services functions, including international and U.S. e-discovery, information governance, compliance, and litigation readiness for corporations, and integration and consolidation of legal technology and support services for law firms. George's expertise includes strategic implementation of practice-specific as well as knowledge and information management solutions and services, including establishing profitable e-discovery functions, building and managing litigation and practice support departments, implementing legal project management, as well as advising on legal process outsourcing, knowledge management, new matter intake, and business conflicts, as well as information center law library functions. He has held senior management positions and legal support at a number of AmLaw 100 law firms, including Shearman and Sterling, and Cravath, Swain, and more. So, George, glad to have you on the show again.
Thank you, Carl. Happy to be here.
Yes. Our second panelist, Ron Hedges, is a five-time presenter on ESI Bytes, trailing only Judge Grimm by one show. Ron has served as United States Magistrate Judge in the District of New Jersey from 1986 to 2007. He's a member of the Sedona Conference Advisory Board and participates in Sedona working groups on e-discovery and records, international e-discovery, and confidentiality public access. Ron's also a member of the advisory boards of the Advanced E-Discovery and Corporate Counsel Institutes of Georgetown University Law Center, where he teaches e-discovery and evidence as an adjunct faculty member. Among many other publications, he's the author of Discovery of Electronically Stored Information, Surveying the Legal Landscape from BNA in 2007, and a co-author of Managing Discovery of Electronic Information, A Pocket Guide for the Judges, Federal Judicial Center, 2007. So, Ron, thanks for coming here again and joining us at ESI Bytes as well. So
you're welcome.
Well,
I hope we don't
like
get taped over today, though.
What?
Hope we don't get taped over today.
Yeah. I've simplified the processing, so I don't think that'll happen. But I always like to start the programs by asking how you got interested in e-discovery. And George, why don't we start with you, since it's a new question for our listeners from you.
Well, I was absolutely certain that I was on my way to law school after my college days and decided to stop by and see how the law firms operate first and foremost before going to law school, and kind of stayed there. Noticed that lawyers have a great tendency of sticking to the old ways of doing work and not really being exposed to all the technological advances. And it's gotten to the point, as I continue to be engaged on the legal side as a legal assistant and case manager, with the cases that the e-discovery started to come up. And that allowed to use my technology background to combine both abilities and start working in litigation and practice support departments inside law firms. dealing primarily with the issues of e-discovery at the very dawn of the e-discovery itself.
Okay, and Ron, yourself?
Well, I wrote an opinion on spoliation back in 2004 or so, and I cited to Shira Shinlin's Zubelite decisions. It was about failure to preserve email, and after that happened, I got an interest in the subject, started reading about it, and I joined Sedona, and that's how it started back in the old days.
Okay. So George, let's start off on the topic. When does international law create challenges in an e-discovery project? Does it start at the collection stage?
Well, I'd like to think that any project, especially a project as complex as e-discovery project, starts with planning. And I would say that in the e-discovery settings, it adds another degree of complexity where the data needs to be mined and collected in various countries around the world. So I would say that the challenges begin at the time of planning, at the time when you actually set up the approach towards the project itself, simply because the presence might be necessary in certain parts of the world, the actual traveling there, understanding the local customs, understanding the local rules around data migration, and I'm sure we'll talk about it in more depth later on, as well as just pure logistics of getting into a country, setting up equipment, using different power and otherwise software settings. A lot of planning goes at the beginning of the project itself when you need to assure that the disruptions to your client are minimal and an ability to come in quickly and assess the data and get the data are at the highest possible efficiency level. So I would say once starting getting engaged in the international project, you need all the details, you need all the perspectives on how the project itself will go and get prepared as much as possible. Obviously, the unpredictable things will happen, but the better prepared you are, the better the project will go.
Okay, and Ron, what about privacy issues? We always hear about privacy issues when we talk about international e-discovery. How do you deal with them, and who are the privacy experts?
The privacy experts, to the extent there are people that are so-called experts, would be the privacy controllers in countries that require them as a matter of law. And what immediately comes to interest or to mind is Europe under the European Privacy Directive. Every member country of the EU has at different levels of government people who are in charge of privacy. And Sedona actually had a meeting in Lisbon a little while ago where a number of these folks showed up. I don't know what that means as far as being an expert. They're basically regulatory officers. But privacy obviously is a central problem that we have in discovery from another country, because we in the United States have, let's say, freewheeling discovery. That's a concept that's alien in just about all the world. And the idea of getting information from, say, Germany or France back to the United States, if it is protected by privacy interests, becomes very difficult. We, of course, have privacy interests in this country. We don't have privacy experts per se here. If I suppose the easiest thing is we have courts who decide what can be private or not. But the United States may or may not be moving towards a regime like Europe has and another number of other countries have. But it's one thing to think about when an American court orders a litigant in front of us to produce personal information from a European country that subscribes to the European Union rules, or other countries such as Australia and Singapore and the like. So I hope that's a simple answer to the question.
Okay, and George, how does one deal with multilingual data sets? You know, what is a Unicode?
Well, obviously in the international settings, the data that you'll be collecting will be in a variety of languages, considering that some of the documents would be written in native and the others would be a mixture of English and a native language. It's lots of issues associated with the multilingual data sets. Some of them are technology-based, the other one are just process-based. And so starting with the Unicode, Unicode is a set of characters that is specifically set up to universally recognize any language, any script out there. Most of the systems that were built in the United States were built based on the ASCII or ASCII 2 table of characters that could at best recognize the Romance languages with the accents of characters. Obviously, once you start collecting data in languages like Russian or Hebrew or Korean or Chinese or Japanese, that table is simply not enough to recognize the characters and therefore will not enable your database to be able to search on those languages. So the Unicode is an extended table that enables processing software to recognize each and every character and create an indexing, create an index accordingly, enabling an end user to search data and get results in those languages. As far as the procedural part of it, when you collect data from several sources and the data is in a variety of languages, one of the most important pieces is to be able to recognize the language of a document. And for practical reasons, obviously, you'll need to figure out how to review those documents, how to actually look at the documents and categorize them accordingly. In some cases, will provide the need for translation or for further comments. So once dealing with the multilingual data sets, it's very important to create an environment in which upon the data processing, you'll get an opportunity to get a field where the actual language recognition will take place and from the very beginning give you a very clear picture which languages are involved in the collection and how many of them and what the breakdown is. Therefore, enabling a variety of experts to work with data, sometimes the natives that would focus on their own language, sometimes, as I mentioned, auto translation or a full translation, depending on the importance of a document. So an approach that can be taken from the very beginning is to get a good understanding of how the data is going to be processed to assure that it can be searched, and then also assuring that the provider that you're using has the language recognition software and probably an ability to auto-translate on the fly when necessary. There's a variety of different functionalities that could be attached to that to make that process as easy as possible.
Also, you know, let's see, Ron, one of the hottest topics in the U.S. is predictive coding, where we're waiting for some guidance from the courts, which I expect we'll get at some point in 2011. Do we run further risks or reduce risk with international privacy issues? For example, with predictive coding, if we're only sampling data for review and not looking at everything and relying on computers to identify data for potential production based on algorithms, is the risk limited or are you still ensnared by the privacy rules?
Well, my first comment would be about one of the hottest topics in the U.S. being predictive coding and waiting for some guidance where I expect we're going to be getting it this year or next year. I'm not quite sure any of that is right from a judicial point of view. Courts will deal with the issues when they come in front of them. Courts will deal with predictive coding issues when they come up, for example, privilege waiver and the like. But I haven't seen that as a hot topic that judges really talk about. It's more lawyers and technologists saying this is the way we need to go because we have to analyze this data. So that may or may not happen. As far as it being a bigger risk or a less risk, I'm going to ask George this for 1 second and tell me if you're going to be going through data and using predictive coding. Is there a way, George, where you anonymize all information so you never have to worry about turning over personal identifiers and the like, or is that something that may well factor into predictive coding?
Yeah, I think it does factor into predictive coding. I think the predictive coding in international settings would probably have two challenges. One is the ability to recognize early and often a private document from a public document. But I think the second one is, as we talked about before, anything technology-wise needs to be sort of upgraded to a level where the predictive coding can operate in a variety of languages and sometimes in a mix of languages. So that's certainly a challenge technologically, because there's going to be, it's bad enough right now with the predictive coding as far as understanding the strategy behind it, because as we all know, the software itself is not going to do a good job unless there is a solid strategy behind the process itself and an ability to really get the results that you're seeking and then verify them. In international settings, obviously in a multilingual setting, it's going to be even more difficult. So what I've seen people do is some of the vendors are now offering an ability to translate some of the terms on the fly. In other words, if one knows the number of languages and that is sort of broken down the actual set of data, is the ability to put the search term in English or the part of the predictive coding strategy in English and then let the machine auto-translate them and disseminate them across all the other languages to assure that the results are consistent. But I think this is certainly a degree of complexity in the already complex strategy around the predictive coding that can get quite complicated in a hurry.
Yep.
I hope you agree, Ron.
I agree.
Well, that tells me that it's something that I think a lot of people fear, that we're going to be turning litigation into a little satellite area where we're going to be spending an enormous amount of time of money just trying to make judges understand what you just said, George. And
right.
I don't mean that pejoratively. It's just judges are generalists. Most of us did not go to MIT or Caltech to go to law school. So that is one challenge I think everyone's going to be facing later on. But the second, just from what George said, I don't think it's going to solve any of our problems with regard to personal information that's protected in other countries. It sounds like the processing is going to have to be done overseas. And then the problem with that, of course, is it's being done for export to the United States. There may be issues with that. And at some point, someone's going to have to go to somebody in Europe and say, hey, we've done all this. Let us send it to the United States. It's okay. And I fear at that point you're going to be caught in European judicial systems, which function very differently than American judicial systems. And I don't know where that takes us. So it's an interesting issue, Carl. The complexity of technology sounds like it's going to make complexity of data transfer even more so.
Yeah, it could, although I would add one thing, since we've had, Senior Master Whitaker from the UK on the show. There is an opinion in England, the Goodale case that Chris Dale has been talking about quite a bit, where the courts actually suggested using this type of technology to deal with a thorny issue. So there's been actually more movement in Europe by the courts embracing this type of approach. But the second thing is, since predictive coding revolves around sampling, there's less likelihood that something irrelevant but personal will come out in mass. But it's still being touched. It's being touched by a machine. It's being touched by processing. So there's a technical issue in here somewhere, but the real issue of people having their data looked at might be somewhat lessened by the predictive coding, because it's working on sampling. But, it's an interesting area. That's what the show's about.
This sounds to me like before anyone would even try to do this in a country with the privacy regime, you would go to a data controller or the like and say, hey, can we do this? And try to explain it. Because I'm not certain you're right that the sampling makes it more or less likely you're going to be getting personal information. The question is going to be, what are you looking for?
Yeah. Exactly.
And depending on that universe of data, you may have a lot of protected information in there.
Well, I'm going to give you a compliment. You sound a lot like Judge Grimm right now. That's exactly his said, come and tell me what you want to do.
Yeah.
Before you do it. Anyway.
Think in general, just to the point that Ron made,
yeah.
It's always a good idea to talk to your privacy expert first, no matter what you do in the international settings. You'd be surprised how much of it would depend on the actual jurisdiction, but also depend on the actual data privacy expert or data officer. Different companies operate in a different way. I often like to say that during the regular course of business, the information is exchanged somewhat freely, if not completely freely, and the issues that arise in regards to privacy are often raised only when the litigation is or investigation is in full process. So there are ways and there are shades of gray that can you can operate under as long as you have a full knowledge and the somewhat of an authority of an operating privacy expert to let you do what you need to do.
Okay. Well, now for something completely different to take the Monty Python line. Ron, one area which has always interested me is how social media seems to be taking over the e-discovery world of CLEs and presentations. You know, there are over 600 million Facebook users on the planet, and just by doing the math, that's a heck of a lot of non-U.S. Facebook pages. Are there any interesting social media issues created by Facebook for litigants internationally?
Oh, what an enormous question. There are serious Facebook issues or social media issues just trying to get some information from the providers in the United States. And just thinking about taking it overseas is just fascinating. And I suppose my first question would be this, my first comment would be this. Where is the vendor that you want to get the information from? Facebook, if I recall, is in the United States. And I honestly can't tell you what Facebook's ownership position is, although I do know, generally speaking, if I want to go onto a Facebook account and befriend someone, I can't have any reasonable expectation of privacy, especially if I have 4,000 or 5,000 friends. So one of the interesting questions may be jurisdictionally, where is the data? Is it enough that someone resides in Europe, for example, and speaks with me in the United States? If I can go to Facebook in the United States and compel the production of that data somehow, then that's a whole other issue because of the Stored Communications Act, whether you can do that. Does a European jurisdiction have any control? I suppose the answer might be yes, because normally what courts do in civil proceedings to get information from social media or any organization that's covered, well, the Stored Communications Act, is a court can compel a person who is registered with that social media site to authorize disclosure. So I suppose if you're involved with some type of transnational litigation, there are individual Facebook pages, an issue or the like, and I as a court went to a litigant in the United States and said, hey, you, befriend me or authorize access, a European regulator might say, you know what, it's a European, it was generated in Europe, it's under the jurisdiction of my nation. I think that's protected. So we haven't seen social media on the international front yet. But I expect there are going to be enormous issues that are going to be coming up about getting access to information. What does consent mean? Now, in Europe, in an employer-employee relationship, for example, that is generally considered to be inherently coercive, so an employee can't be considered to give true consent. Now, if you're in litigation in the United States and a court orders you to do something, I have a serious problem thinking a European controller would say that subject or citizen of my country has given meaningful or true consent by disclosing information. So I don't really have an answer to this, Carl. All I know is social media is growing. There was a prediction by, I believe, a Google executive a while ago that within a few years, the volume of information will double every 11 hours, primarily coming through social media and the like. Some of the traditional, I hate to say traditional in such a short time, ESI sources like email may be going down. It's a fascinating area, but I don't think there's any answer to it, and I don't know if anyone has actually tackled the question of social media on an international basis. George, have you heard of anything about that?
No, not yet. Certainly, absolutely a fascinating area, but yep. I think there's time to come on this one.
That's why yep. ESI Bytes is so much fun. We go where nowhere else will go.
Yes, we do.
All right, well, let's go to something that people do talk a lot about. George, traditionally, on programs, people, when they talk about international e-discovery, we seem to gravitate towards Europe a lot. Is there anything happening in the rest of the world, Asia, countries of the former Soviet Union, China, you know, something that might interest our listeners from that perspective?
Yeah, there's certainly things happening there as well. I think one of the important things to note that the notion of privacy and data protection are slowly making their way from Europe into other parts of the world, and I know Chinese government is working on the privacy rules for the data. But there are other things, some of which are cultural in nature, some of them are just procedural, as far as an ability to, as I mentioned before, to get into the country to begin with, but then also to get the data out. And I always like to talk about the cultural aspects of it. Obviously, someone like me, it comes naturally. I was born in the Soviet Union, you know, came to America 20 years ago, so cultural adoption and the differences in culture is my personal favorite. But also had a lot of experience collecting data in Asia, in the Middle East, and also in the countries of the former Soviet Union. The bottom line is you need to be prepared, and we talked about preparedness earlier, to be able to adapt to the local customs and understand the priorities, understand why certain things are happening a certain way. I recall a situation when we were collecting data in China, and we were interviewing potential custodians, and we quickly learned that the actual exposure to the other people is quite important in this part of the world. There was a comment made that an employee complained to HR that since he was questioned by a group of Americans in black suits, he must have done something wrong. So those things cannot be visible to the others. We even devised a plan of each of the employee going into a conference room when we were interviewing them that will be invisible to the others. So cultural aspects are quite on the map there. Also, as far as taking the data out of the country, there's an aspect that's present in any of the countries that are still communist countries, so ex-communist countries, where there was a full control of a government over the companies. And the question of government secrets come up immediately, and the argument that is made is if a company at any given point was working on a government project, there was a possibility that something that they were producing or the information that was exchanged in that time is subject to privacy from a perspective of government secrets. So there is a whole process that needs to be established to identify ways to collect the data without disturbing that particular clause. There's also a question of customs, of how the data can be taken out of the country. I recently had a project in the Middle East when I had to take data out of Israel, and given the security in the airport and everything around it, it was very good to know what needed to be done in advance. There was a conversation about it that I've engaged in prior to arriving into the country and establishing a protocol as far as the documentation and the letters, and everything went well because of that. So a lot of local customs that need to be studied in advance, and understanding how to get permissions, also important. People talk about knowing a card-carrying party member when you work in China. It's a very useful thing to have.
Well, Ron, I know we've talked about top 10 cases with you at the end of the year, and sometimes sort of in the middle of the year with some of the, at least three of the shows we've done with you. Can you give us a sneak peek to next year and identify any international cases you think listeners should take notice of?
Well, one of the cases would be the Horaeus Culser, which is interesting. It was out of the Seventh Circuit, but it was not a request for data coming into the United States. It was a request for data coming out of the United States for use in German litigation. So it was kind of the flip side of what we talk about. And it wasn't personally protected information or the like, but it's going back to the Aerospatial decision from the Supreme Court in the 1980s and going through factors to decide whether an American court should allow information to be used overseas in response to a foreign request. As far as into the United States, there's nothing particularly I would think about other than there is a decision a short time ago where there was an attempt made to secure information that had been submitted to a European Commission antitrust unit, if you will call it that, here in the United States for more or less parallel litigation in the U.S., and the U.S. court declined to require that information to be produced, saying, now, this is something that was generated at the bequest of a European government. It wasn't voluntarily created. We are not going to invade the confidentiality of the process in Europe by having the information come back. So I think we're beginning to see a lot more layers of complexity as far as government involvement on both sides, what exactly the information is going to be used for, and also what alternate sources are there for the information that you're trying to get from a foreign country. So will any of these make my top 10? I don't know. There's a lot of stuff going on this year, and we're only halfway through, so we'll see.
So, George, you know, and also for you, Ron, since we're all consultants in this field, the complexity is not necessarily bad news, right?
Well, probably not.
But anyway, all right. Well, the last question I wanted to ask, we'll start with you, George, because we just talked to Ron about his cases, and then you, Ron. Any predictions on where we're likely to see more changes in e-discovery in the international law area? You know, where the trends are heading right now.
Yeah, Ron mentioned social media. That's obviously going to be a battleground. That's going to be interesting to watch and see how it's going to be affected. I think the other parts that need to be watched is the fact that the privacy itself as a notion is slowly making its way out of Europe into the rest of the world. Even here in the U.S., we are looking at it as well. I think there's going to be a change in the way that that corporations in general will treat personal information and what would be a criteria of an access to it. And, of course, as the world is getting smaller, literally there's going to be a whole issue of looking at the data that's located on the cloud, given that the data on the cloud is never in one place at any particular time, that there's going to be issues in regards to conflicting sort of a data transfer issues between the convenience of a cloud and the privacy and the cross-jurisdictional data movement.
Okay, Ron, feel free to repeat anything George said. He gave some good answers there.
Well, I wish I had some. The first thing I would suggest is that from what I read, more countries around the world are adopting these privacy rules. And we talk about international discovery, we talk about privacy rules, but they're also blocking statutes that are intended to protect, for example, commercial information coming out of countries. France is notorious for having a blocking statute. As we're moving forward and competition, business competition becomes more stressful, if you will, across the world. We have the rise of China that George was talking about before and the like. I expect we're going to see more blocking statutes, formally or informal. I also expect we're certainly going to be seeing more conflicts, getting information back and forth as businesses become multinational and the like. I expect this is an area that's going to be expanding, Carl.
Sounds good. Well, I want to thank both of you, George and Ron, for joining us here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year, and hopefully this show records. to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember the show and website phonetically as it's Easy Bytes of ESI information. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and owner of ReviewLess and good friend of Jurnov, wishing you a nice day.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, George.